Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis. We're going to continue our explorations of the cultures of consciousness. And as you know, nothing particularly bizarre seemed to happen on December 21st, 2012. Maybe there was an internal shift, a strange dream, some great parties here and there. But no noticeable shift in the overall character of space-time. I think that's a fair conclusion to be made, which raises the question, what do we do with these kinds of apocalyptic moments, these moments of intensity that people anticipate? How do we understand them? You know, it's so easy just to say, oh, it's just a bunch of hooey. People are kooks. They've been doing this throughout history. When are they going to stop? But they're not going to stop. Because there's something profound in the apocalyptic moment. It's just that the tendency of human beings is, I believe, to literalize things that are more properly seen in a poetic or transcendental mode. And one place to look at this, and in fact one of the reasons that we found the 2012 meme bubbling along with such alacrity in these globalized, internetized days, was the way it was fueled, I think, by a certain kind of very intense set of experiences, expectations, hopes, and pragmatic dreams that we find in the global dance, electronic dance community, and particularly the community known as Psytrance or the broader neo-tribal scene, who have taken the opportunities of the electronic dance music party and pushed them to their farthest extremes of entrancement, entrainment, contemporary mythology, and to some degree an apocalyptic sensibility, meaning not violence and destruction of the order of some black metal revelators on evil horses, but rather the visionary capacity taken to the level of a whole society or indeed a whole globe. And with excellent timing, I'm happy to say that Graham St. John's new book is out, The Global Tribe, Technology, Spirituality, and Psytrance. And we've had Graham on the show before, and he is without a doubt the most thorough and tenacious scholar, practitioner, really, if you can think about it, working on the Psytrance, the global Psytrance scene, and the many dimensions and questions that it raises. And he's written and edited a number of books already, but to my mind, Global Tribe is really, so far anyway, his definitive account of this fascinating overlap of technology, spirituality, neo-tribalism, electronics, psychedelics, this very, very interesting and still often rather ignored subculture, at least for people who are not interested in that particular junction of dimensions. And so I look forward to talking to Graham. But before that, we'll bring on our co-host here in Expanding Mind, Maja Daou. Hi, Maja.
Hi, Eric. How's it going?
It's good. It's good. So did you feel anything on December 21st that was out of the ordinary? Did you open yourself up? Did you put out a prayer? Did you get any tremors, synchronicities, dreams?
I did. I actually led a ritual. I helped people practice dying, which is this little thing I do where you do a breathing technique where you kind of hold your breath for as long as you can. You breathe out all the air you have. Like, I know a lot of people, when you hold your breath, you'll breathe in as much air as you can, and then you kind of hold it. But I like to do the style where you breathe out all of your air, and then you try and, like, do stuff like push-ups or run around. So, like, you push out all your air, and then you try and see how far you can run with no air. So it kind of, like, trains your body to not have a total freak attack and get scared if you can't breathe. So you kind of just, you know, get ready to die so that when you do die, you don't have to be totally afraid and die with fear. So I did that with a nice little group of about 45 or 50 people, and it was pretty great. Everybody really liked dying together, so it was fun.
Wow, is that part of a regular thing that you teach, or was it sort of a special event for that day?
It was a special event for that day, put on by this friend of mine named Brent, who calls himself Future Eyes, and he makes these like little time travel glasses that have kaleidoscopes in them. I don't know how else to describe
this. This all sounded pretty 2012.
Yeah, it was very fun. I had a good time.
That's I've tried. It's funny. I think that night I was also, how was a strange synchronicity. I was also seeing how far I could hold my breath, because friends of mine, we exchanged gifts, and they had this wonderful little device that you stick onto your finger and will measure not only your pulse but your blood oxygen level. And so if we go into meditative states or if we held our breath for a long time. And one of my friends was a scuba diver, and he can hold his breath for like 3 minutes. And it was interesting to just sort of see like where you start to, you know, shift the blood, the oxygen in your lungs, and then what that has to do with your kind of panic level. So we were having that same conversation synchronistically that very night.
That's totally crazy.
There you go.
That's so good.
All right. Well, with that, we're going
to
bring on.
I wanted to slip in really quick. The world record for holding your breath underwater is 19 minutes, which
that's
is just crazy.
I can't. Yeah. You know, I thought it was about 15. That's almost 20 minutes. That's like the length of a sitcom. It's crazy. anyway, let's bring on Graham St. John. Graham, thanks so much for joining us here on Expanding Mind.
Well, thanks for having me, Eric. It's an honor.
Wonderful. So what did you do for the big day?
Well, it was reasonably quiet, actually. We had a quiet event here in the Land of Oz on the flight deck above the town of Nimbin. I know there was a lot of major events around the world, so it was a bit disappointing not to be at one of those major events. But I think we joined the ethereal, and we participated nonetheless. So, despite all the hype leading up to that, in terms of major events, we had a small gathering here, which was lovely.
That's wonderful. Well, I'm curious how you came to think about that whole sort of sense of expectation. Not so much the way that it got blown up in the media, and then the usual stories, and then how it spread into, you know, different kind of, you know, other kinds of communities, but really the way in which it was an important meme or idea or set of expectations, you know, within the psytrance, the dance culture world that you, you know, have spent such a long time, you know, observing, writing about, experiencing, plumbing the depths of the meaning of, and so I'm just kind of curious how you came to understand the sort of balance of maybe poetry and literalism, the way in which it's at once sort of a utopian, almost virtual kind of possibility that's being pointed to with the sense of expectation, the sense of a world transformation, and then at the same time the way that, it, at least in certain circumstances, it became very literalized with a specific date, with a specific calendrical engine, you know, attached to a certain moment, you know, a certain idea set in motion by Terence McKenna and others. And I'm just curious, because it was a rich part of that world, that global tribe. How did you come to sort of think about it, experience it, see it?
Yeah, I guess I was exposed to that whole meme and mythos through you know, major festivals like the Boom Festival, for instance, but even before that in Australia, back in 2000, there was an event called Earth Dream. Now, this wasn't specifically a psychedelic trance event. This was a very multi-genred anti-nuclear activism orientated event, actually, and there was a series of events that spiraled up the guts of the continent in Australia, and most of it wasn't anticipated. It was just it just snowballed, and I guess it was through that event, which was orchestrated by Robin Mutoid from the Mutoid Waste Company, who envisioned having a major celebration in Central Australia, a mega tribal gathering in visual proximity of Uluru in 2000, and that was 12 years ago, and he envisioned that 12 years before that, and I think that was subsequent to Jose Agüel's harmonic convergence, which I think was in 87. So there was a series of visionary events, and specifically in Australia, and there was, and Robin Mutoid and quite a few other people were influenced by the dream spell calendar. So it was a dream spell calendar technology that I guess allowed a lot of people to be exposed to these ideas and get their galactic signature. And I recall I received my galactic signature, not even knowing what the hell that was, in 2000, and there was a momentum to hold these events in Central Australia at a place called Newtonia on the day out of time, which in the dream spell calendar is, I believe, the 26th of
July, right?
Is it June or July? I don't even know. And there's been a series of events each year spiraling up to this year. And unfortunately, I didn't get out there this year. So I'm a bit isolated at the moment, so I'm going to be curious to see actually what happened.
Well, what do you think is the relationship between the kind of experiences that people can have collectively at dance music events when there's really an explicit sort of element of trance, of visionary activity, of really trying to sort of mythologize the moment, the relationship between those experiences that people have, you know, on the dance floor, in the space, and this kind of sense of history as something that could change dramatically, or as history is something that's coming to an end or a transformation point. It seems like there's some connection there, but it's not clear to me what it is.
Yeah, I think it has channeled a great deal of anxieties that have been building up over the last couple of decades about the directions that we're going in this planet, and as a reflection of rippling crises, humanitarian, ecological, and psychological, and it's these anxieties that have led people to grab onto almost a millenarian type of movement, which is not really for many people within psychedelic culture an apocalyptic scenario. It's more of a millenarian scenario. It's more of a culture of expectancy and of hope and of rebirth rather than death. So there's a great deal of hope and good vibes associated with dance movements, which where it's kind of curious where there's in the context of dance, and many people talk about what they're downloading within, you know, trance states and within states where they're going out of their minds and dissolving, rational thought, being exposed to new ideas in a timeless state, but it is at the same time very associated with precision timing in terms of certain dates and so on. So those kinds of paradoxes are really important. And the book, my book, Global Tribe, isn't really so much about this millenarian movement. I've written about that elsewhere. In fact, I've had to remove a lot of material from the book that turned out to be quite lengthy.
On that topic?
On the topic of 2012, yeah. So that's going to be the subject for another project, probably not a book, but maybe a couple of articles.
Well, it's interesting. You mentioned paradox, because it seems to me that that's And even in throughout your book, one of the things you do is to draw attention to a number of, if not paradoxes, then at least polarities that are going on, you know, in this movement. And there's a number of those that we could talk about that I pulled out that really interested me. And maybe one to just start with is the global and the local. I think one of the things that seems interesting to me, and you can, you know, give me your own twist, which on it, is that on the one hand, this psychedelic dance culture, electronic dance culture, is truly global music in a way that there's some other, you know, genres of music or musical cultures that have that degree of kind of global presence, in the sense that, you know, whatever, black metal fans from Paraguay can, you know, relate to black metal fans from Russia on some level or whatever. There's a kind of universal language in certain kinds of metal that is very global, and it's true with psytrance as well, and even more so to some degree in the sense that the relative lack of specific languages of vocals as a central point to the musical meanings means that it's even more accessible on this scale. And because so much of the consciousness of the music and of the culture has to do with, you know, with coming to some kind of global awareness, it's picking up some of these you know, new age and metaphysical ideas about global consciousness and the Gaian mind, etc. But at the same time, it's an incredibly richly expressed movement or ethos on a very local level, and there's a strong sense in all the scenes that I've ever been familiar with of very specific landscapes, specific crews, specific ways of organizing the party. And you talk about, you know, in this book about both of these elements, about the global visions, but also about particular scenes. Scenes in Israel, which are fascinating, in Australia, fascinating, you know, and then in the States and of course in UK and in Europe and the kind of homeland of Goa. So I just kind of wanted to encourage you to maybe riff a bit on this tension between the global and the local, and what psytrance, what this culture kind of lets us see and understand about how to be both global citizens and very local bodies, in a way.
Yeah, it's been a fascinating journey over the last 10, 15 years. It goes out, I guess, to 15 years, because there's material in the book that goes back to my first outdoor trance party, actually, in Australia in 95, and my subsequent exposure to the, you know, chasing the rabbit down the hole and being exposed to this labyrinth of labyrinthine network that is very transnational, and finding myself popping up in events around the world, you know, including you know, places like Germany, where it initially Goa trance really took off subsequent to the fall of the wall. And in of course many other places where one experiences an intense familiarity because the scenes and the styles and the sounds, especially in I guess the late 90s and going into the 2000s, there was a sense of sort of collective spirit there, that especially in post Soviet countries and new liberalizing democracies, where trance was taken up as a vehicle of creative expression that hadn't been, that, you know, young people hadn't been really exposed to before in those countries. And we've seen that, you know, more recently in South America and Central America and many other countries, and of course, I guess there seems to be a sort of graduation ceremony that happens every 2 years in Portugal, and I mentioned before the Boom Festival, And I guess that's really the exemplary global event. We can talk about, I mean, the project has been called Global Tribe, but it's almost frankly ridiculous that one person could have some sort of commanding view over the international scene, because it's just impossible. I mean, even a collection of people who were contributors to a book called Goa, 20 Years of Psychedelic Trance, which is a fabulous book published first in German and then English a couple of years ago, which has about 500 colored photographs and about 30 or 40 chapters by different individuals in the scene. Even that book fails to really get into the depth of the global phenomenon, although it probably does a lot more than my own book in its own way. But the book is more about global events and those events that have arisen downstream from Goa itself, and the 25 or more seasons of intensive activity in Goa, where DJs and producers and other artists from around the world were importing their own styles and methods and aesthetics into Anjuna and other beaches and hinterlands in Goa, and creating a trance dance style that was subsequently reproduced in the form of festivals, in the form of spiritual technologies that are these amazing events. And of course, Boom is directly a response to, or it arose from a desire to recreate these experiences in the form of a festival, in the form of a seven-day event, which has a full moon during the event, just like the full moon beach parties in Goa in the 70s and 80s. And yes, very, very global. The dance floor, the main dance floor at Boom, is called the Dance Temple. And there's no other floor I know of where you can be exposed to a sound bath of languages. And I think in 2012, which was the fourth Boom Festival I went to, you can be on the dance floor with people from up to 100 different countries. And that's a significant experience. There are no other dance scenes, much electronic or otherwise, music scenes, where I think you get that vast diversity. And of course, when I say diversity, there are very few representatives from disadvantaged countries involved. But I think what we've seen in the last 20 years is the development of this scene, where cultural brokers who are from advantaged cultural brokers within countries have initially sown the seeds of psychedelic trance within different countries, and that's subsequently been exposed to people from less advantaged backgrounds within those countries, and we've seen that in Australia, for instance.
Yeah, I mean, since you're from Australia and you grew up in that scene, you know that scene so well. Give us a little sense about what's particular about the issues that have come up there, and particularly, I would be curious about what sorts of relationships with Aboriginal communities have been like. I mean, I know that that's one thing that happens in different communities. It's happened among groups that I'm familiar with here on the West Coast, where there's various bridges are attempted to be built between Aboriginal or Native American communities, in this case, and these sort of groups of relatively privileged, largely white, neo-tribal folk, and sometimes it's successful, sometimes it's really difficult, but because this idea of tribe and this idea of primary traditions and of a kind of, archaic consciousness is so important to at least one aspect of the scene, I can only imagine there must be some very interesting engagements and complexities in Australia as well.
For sure. I think each country has its unique elements, but within settler countries like Australia and the United States and Canada and South Africa and New Zealand, we've seen some interesting alliances and collaborations between traditional custodians and settlers within events. I think each event is unique. We can look at events like the Rainbow Serpent Festival in Australia, which was remains one of the key psychedelic events, although like many other events, it's diversified. And that has a unique ritual elements to it, a major opening ceremony and closing ceremony that is that are conducted by local indigenous custodians. And the opening ceremony at Rainbow Serpent has become quite a internationally known phenomenon, which I guess in the spirit of reconciliation is a legitimation ceremony. It purifies the land and enables those who've come to visit the festival to engage in a legitimate occupation of the land, which is a very respectful way of going about dance. And of course, and there are similar types of purification or legitimation events, ceremonies in other countries, in Canada, and so that's a very respectful way of partying.
Yeah, no, it's I think it's a really it's a very positive sign that at least as far as I can understand that there have been a number of really as you say, respectful ways of integrating this, and not just going beyond the usual exoticization and the long history of unfair appropriation. But we're going to take a break right now, and we'll come back with more questions for Graham St. John, who we're talking to here on Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Dau. We'll be right back after this.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Dau. We're here with Eric Davis, and we're speaking with Graham St. John, and we're talking about big parties. And, Graham, it just really strikes me, and I want to know what your opinion is on this. I mean, so you've been to a lot of these festivals, I assume, and kind of taken in a pretty good amount of them. What, in your opinion, why do you think people just have, like, as human beings, we get together and have huge parties, and we love to do this. And like you said, like, this has grown, the festival culture has grown into something that is so amazing. We now have huge parties that extend around the world. Like, I know, before the break, you guys were talking about some of them and those implications, but what do you think, like, as people, like that kind of search for the biggest, global party that reaches people everywhere, like that concept, that drive in us. I mean, what do you kind of feel like is driving these people to make these festivals happen and go down?
Well, that's a good question. I guess it ultimately comes down to wanting to feel connected with others and outside of your local region, and I guess you have events like Earth Dance, which are it's a literally transnational event, which happens in the same in around the world in hundreds of locations all at one time, where people are connected by a global link-up. The desire to dissolve one's personal boundaries in the company of others, who are often strangers, potentially friends, I think is a distinctive element of the psychedelic heritage, which literally does involve the dissolution of boundaries. And we're talking about events that are highly optimized and re-optimized to maximize the potential for experiencing mystical states of consciousness and experiencing Gnostic states, experiencing the dissolution of one's boundaries. And so that's what's interested me, and I guess in this book is the optimization of events, the augmenting of technologies, whether they be chemical, digital, or cyber, or other technologies that are optimized to create a sort of hyperliminal environments that are hyperliminal because they're powerful thresholds. And of course,
if you look back in history, I mean, you can look at places where people would come together from around the world. And I mean, albeit some of them were kind of maybe debatably using, conscious altering, substances or things like that, like maybe the Eleusinian Mysteries, where, people would travel from all over the globe to come and have this experience and do it, but it wasn't quite like a party situation. And then you'd have Alexandria, where people would come from everywhere, and it was kind of like there would be places that there were locations that would be spots where everyone would go, and then, when you put everyone's mind together, there's no doubt that, like you said, you dissolve, and then you also have an experience where your consciousness increases, even if it's just by, being around all those people from all over the world. But now, with the parties, it's almost like we get to do something like Alexandria, except, like you said, the conditions are more optimal. So it's like if it was Alexandria, but everybody was cool and everyone was having a good time with everybody else, and then they could share their minds with each other,
Yeah, well, you mentioned the Festival at Eleusis. That's probably the first international festival. It's certainly the longest running. 2,000 years, and I think there is some incredible likenesses between an event like that and events like Bloom. And in fact, one of my colleagues, Chiara Baldini, has been comparing the Rites of Eleusis with the Boom Festival, and she'd be coming up with some interesting, striking parallels in terms of strangers coming together and experiencing sort of lifelong bonds, in terms of being exposed to mystical states of consciousness in a collective sense, and in terms of cultic or occultic practices. You know, really kind of interesting research that she's embarking on. And these events, one of the aspects of the book is looking at the history of psychedelic consciousness and history of the recent history of the psychedelic renaissance, which really questions, what is psychedelia? And I think that when we're looking at these events, we're looking at the sometimes disparate and sometimes complementary trends towards losing your mind and towards developing your mind. And in terms of gaining new techniques and new ways of living and being. And when you go to an event like Boom, going back to Boom, it's really a fascinating event. where they have, and I know that Eric's familiar with this, they have an area called the Liminal Village, which is like the head of the festival to the dance temple's body of the festival. Both of these, and there are many other aspects of the festival, of course, but both of these aspects of that particular festival, which are replicated, in, I guess, in smaller scale in many other events, are as equally important to that festival and equally important to what we know as psychedelic. And I think the whole question of psychedelia is constantly being evolving and being debated and discussed within those environments. But the idea of being able to be with others on major dance floors that are optimized for advanced states of liminality is very important.
Yeah, one of the things that interests me particularly about the Liminal Village, where people are presenting information, they're giving talks, and this was something I started to notice going to festivals, you know, around a decade or so ago, where there was suddenly just kind of the sense that one way to make to allow, you know, create more offerings and create a more integrated, more multidimensional experience was to really put some attention to having talks and workshops and permaculture and you know, people who like to, you know, riff on big ideas and draw people together and pass on information, and this kind of desire to have lore and knowledge alongside these techniques of experience and heart opening and a more nonverbal kinds of experiences of liminality. And you know, one of the things that I was thinking of is if you think about, I mean, we don't really know what happened at Eleusis or other sorts of major gatherings. But one thing that, you know, is pretty clear is that there was a sort of general mythology that in some sense by going there, by making the trek, by sort of sacrificing your time and money and whatever you had to do to get there, and then you go through these experiences and there's difficulties and also things that are just kind of like a pig roast, you know, just sort of like a body fun, and then there's these moments of sublimity when the whole crowd is witnessing and experiencing directly some mystery. But there's also, you know, a whole set of, you know, there's a lot of lore. There's specific gods and goddesses. There's a mythology about what happened to them. That the event itself is kind of, as you find in a lot of traditional cultures, is kind of a recapitulation of a mythic narrative. Persephone's, you know, getting taken into the underworld, and Pluto, and all these sort of characters. And then when you come to this modern situation, we have this powerful technologies of liminality that clearly open up mythopoetic consciousness, not just on an individual, but on a collective level that's embodied in the people at the moment, but also in a larger sense of a kind of epochal, cultural shift. And yet at the same time, like, no one's going to, like, lay down, this is the myth. You know, this is what it's about, you know, the return of Quetzalcoatl. Yeah. You know, that only gets you so far. It's something else. It's not just about opening up altered states and creating a kind of new collective mythic narrative. There's something else that's more multidimensional, that's more in process. You know, and it's almost like the ideas, the myths have to be kept kind of in process, and these things like the Liminal Village, it becomes a site of people probing and experimenting what else happens besides that dissolution. I mean, to put it in a simple question to you, clearly that with all of these technologies, we're getting better and better at being able to create powerful, liminal, dissolving, collective states of ecstatic transport through music and visuals and psychedelics and cultural expectations. But there's also this question of what new forms come, how does it crystallize, how does it re-embody itself after going through that liminal environment. And in a way, that's almost more the trickier question, and that's what I'm really curious about, what kind of visions you came to in your research in terms of how people move through these, either collectively or individually, and then reconstruct something new.
Yeah, you're right. There is no hierophant within these scenes, no I guess they're they're visionary artists who become almost like rock stars who move through these scenes, which is an interesting phenomenon. But no hierophant as such, which is the spiritual authority in the Eleusinian ritual. I guess the most successful events are those that give people, each individual, the opportunity to participate in the creation of the event. And whether we call that a prosumer or something else, we're talking about the enablement of individuals to create and co-create an event and to consume an experience that they themselves are involved in producing, and to reproduce that event. So if events are annual or every 2 years or somewhat seasonal or even a few times during the year, these events are being re-optimized with the contribution of more participants, so that based on feedback, events can improve over time. Or in many cases, you see offshoot events that for some reason or another are collectives of people seeking something different, perhaps something more uniquely communal, perhaps with more of an intention, perhaps with more of a intent to engage in a transformative experience that is solid or collective, based on collective mythologies. I know that there are events around the world which have that small scale intention. Such an event is called Intent in British Columbia, and there are. And there are other types of experiences, such as the likes of Goa Gill, for instance, procures every year. He's got a fairly busy schedule, about 30 events every year, up to 24-hour dance rituals, where it's basically him playing for 24 hours, mostly a dark, punishing, apocalyptic music that has grown out of his experience in Goa, and many other events that have a shamanic bent, with DJs who are keen on controlling and directing the sequence of events. And also within larger events that become more and more like cities, with suburbs, with a whole range of options available for people that are generally realms of indeterminacy, generally realms of uncertainty, because the outcomes, unlike rites of passage, which have a telos where you can more or less predict what's going to happen at the end of the transition in terms of status transition change or and so on. Within a more hyperliminal environment such as these events, the outcomes are unpredictable, and I think for a great many participants that's a desirable thing. And I know that we can talk about events like Burning Man, of course Burning Man is not a rave and not a psychedelic trance festival. Although initially there was Goa Trance in the mid to late 90s, and I believe Gil also played a few times at a place called the Community Dance after the burn in the late 90s. Burning Man is, I guess, the optimal environment where there is no, where the organization does not provide a definition or prescription for experience. It is open, that the burn itself is open to interpretation, and that there are as many outcomes from that experience as there are
Right. And now, what do you think that says about spirituality today? I mean, you have this sort of nebulous but very important term in your subtitle, and you do a wonderful job of illuminating some of the, you know, it's very easy to kind of caricature, you know, the spirituality of you know, drug gobbling hippies, but there's a lot more going on there, and it seems to me there's something about spirituality that we can learn from these scenes that has to do with that openness, with that indeterminacy, with the fact that it's sort of, it's like a rite of passage where it's not clear and in fact not allowed in a way to realize itself in some very coherent and stable identity. But it's a very tricky area, and I'm sure you have some light to shed on it.
Yeah, I guess it's open-ended, where events are enabling individuals to create their own mythologies and identities that are associated with events themselves. I mean, I know a lot of people who become, you know, almost religious about certain events and defending those events from the law or from tourists or from elements that are to jeopardize those events. So they are tribal in that respect, and I know that you've engaged in the study of the history of neo-tribal events in the West Coast, which has its own history and fascinating history that you've traced in tribal revival. And I think that, and obviously there's a lot of people in that West Coast network who are through experiencing those events, those annual events and those annual rituals, approach these events with a sense of conviction, and we'll defend those experiences and those events, especially at times when there may be crisis or where those events may be subject to some forms of intervention or change based on attracting the wrong kinds of people and so on.
Sure. Well, how do you see your role in there? I mean, there's a, you know, you're a very good scholar, so you do your homework and you present a lot of knowledge, a lot of information. There's dense with data. I mean, someone can go through your book and, you know, have a million playlists of key tracks to hunt down and listen to just to speak of the music alone. But there's also a sense I get in your work that while you're not by any means proselytizing, you are definitely trying to articulate the depth, the complexity, the value generation, the positive character of these events and the kind of culture that it's generated, you know, you're trying to like give it the best shake you can. And I'm curious how you see your own role in participating in these events, in, you know, creating your books and doing your research, in terms of your own kind of fidelity or your own kind of a commitment to this culture.
Yeah, of course, I do have a strong love for dance, and it's been quite a flourishing evolution over the last 20 years. And in a way, this book is a defensive position because it really, you know, in the vast disparities of this movement, I think there's something that is worthwhile holding on to, and it is a movement. And recently, I experienced my fifth total solar eclipse festival, which was here in Australia in Far North Queensland this last month. Second total solar eclipse event in Australia, and I think these events in themselves are exemplary psychedelic festivals. They're not, by any stretch of the imagination, purely psytrance. The most recent event, Eclipse 2012, near Cairns, had about five or six stages. It was probably the most immaculate festival that we've had experienced in this country. It was transnational. But what's unique about the festival is that it has a headline act that is unparalleled, and of course is the eclipse itself, a total solar eclipse, where the moon blocks the sun, and where those who gather are, I guess, joining forces to ensure the return of the sun. It's a unique festival in the world where a cosmic event can pull together people from around the world and genuflect, and each of the dance floors was like going to a different country. There was many Japanese and many Germans, and this was in a remote place where the event would never happen again, and it was my second eclipse this year. I was in at the Symbiosis Festival in Nevada earlier this year for the celebration of an annular solar eclipse, which was probably the biggest celebration for an annual solar eclipse now. So these events have taken on their own.
A friend of mine actually played that eclipse festival. His name is Eskimo. His name is Brendan Angelitis, but he plays as Eskimo. And it was so funny because before he even got invited to play the festival, he had witnessed an eclipse and actually looked at it for a second, which you're not supposed to do. But he totally did, and like had this amazing experience, and then immediately like got invited to play that festival. And I was just curious if you like have had, like in going to that one where you were there, were you able to dissolve and kind of have, like, I know a lot of the people that attend the eclipse festivals have these like cosmic moments. Did you experience anything like that while you were there?
Well, I did. It was like, at that event, it was like experiencing the eye of God. It's very different than a total solar eclipse because you get more of an iris effect. And, yeah, it's like somewhere between the eye of God and a portal. And a portal that opens up in precise time and place and won't do so again for, on an average, 300 years. But certainly not in our lifetime. An incredible event where I think at that festival there was 8,000 to 10,000 people, and so everything stops and everyone gathers in the same location to for the duration of the eclipse, which can take hours, in fact. But the central moment is only a few minutes. And these events have been happening since, I think, 94 was the first so-called eclipse raid, and that was in Chile. And that involved maybe a couple of hundred people, people from Goa. And so over the years, these events have been transpiring in remote locations and getting bigger attracting a diverse range of people, obviously people from the local regions, but people who are part of a traveling culture. And I meet a lot of people who I don't meet outside of these events, and I meet them in various parts of the world. So it's the people who have become eclipse chasers, and I guess it's very difficult to describe an eclipse experience to someone who hasn't seen it. It's almost like 100 full moons at once. And yet these experiences have attracted people from around the globe.
Well, that's a wonderful vision. You know, we started out talking about, you know, globalism and versus the tribe, and it's really not even just the globe. It's really the kind of cosmic dimension, literally, you know, not simply as a metaphor for the cosmos, but really gearing the dance to a cosmic moment. Yeah, but we're going to have to end it there. So please, folks, check out Global Tribe by Graham St. John, Technology, Spirituality, and Psytrance. Graham, thanks so much for being on Expanding Mind.
Well, thanks very much for having me, Eric. Thank you.
It was great. Okay, from me and Majid Ali out there, keep your minds open.